All right, City Council will come back from recess. Sue, can you please read the title for our next item?
Item 1001, adopt new supporting documents for an update of Portland's comprehensive plan.
When I took office, the city had just started the state-mandated process of periodic review of the comprehensive plan. We put that aside momentarily so that we could complete an actual strategic plan for the city that would then serve to guide the comprehensive plan work. It is about the comp plan follows from the Portland plan, and it's about partnerships, working deeply with partner agencies to develop joint strategies. It's about people, planning for people, not just bricks and mortar development. It's about equity, foundation of the plan, and it's not a state planning requirement, but it should be. And it's fact-based. We spent a lot of time vetting the facts that would inform the work of the comprehensive plan. In introducing the updating the comprehensive plan, we have to, this is the factual basis of the comprehensive plan, and I know Commissioner Shapiro knows every page by heart, every word.
We have it read into the record.
Sam, I actually talked to Commissioner Shapiro during the break.
Yes.
And he was, because he was in such rapt attention while you were running through the agenda for the last 5 minutes, and he told me that he thought that once upon a time he was the fastest gavel in the West. He's now ready, right? He said he's ready to relinquish the title.
Well, I think I will stop there, other than to say we will hold the record open for a week, so we won't be taking a vote today, so that in addition to the testimony we receive, that others can email in and staff can respond. So with that, Director Anderson.
And with me here today is the person you've already alluded to, Howard Shapiro, who is on the Planning and Sustainability Commission, and Eric Engstrom, who is principal planner and leading up the comprehensive plan. Joe Zender, chief planner, is also here with us today. So, you know, over the past few years, we have brought primarily sort of big picture issues to council related to planning in terms of things like the Portland plan. So today we're going to step down from the big picture and really look at the facts and the details. The factual basis for the comprehensive plan was developed by staff from our bureau, but also from many other bureaus, with assistance from experts from many different fields. It's officially the analysis step of the Portland's state-mandated periodic review process. The reports create the foundation for the comprehensive plan and include deep analysis on economic opportunity, on housing needs, on infrastructure condition and capacity, things like streets and roads and pipes and parks. The reports include a natural resource inventory and a buildable lands inventory. This work really identifies the key issues, opportunities, and problems that we need to solve in developing the comprehensive plan. Let me just give you one quick example. A key finding from this research shows that by 2035, the number of households in Portland is expected to grow by 132,000 households, and the number of jobs will grow by 147,000. And the data shows that even with this growth, we currently have enough space, enough zone capacity to accommodate housing needs, and most but not quite enough land for all of the job categories. So, for example, with this information, we're now moving to the next step in the comprehensive plan, and we're developing solutions to ensure that we have enough industrial and institutional land and zone capacity. So one way really to think about this pile of reports, if it was bound, is sort of like the encyclopedia that at least all of you and I had when we were in elementary school. The reports are essential for fact-based problem solving. As we do the comprehensive plan, they'll be useful in policy and program development for all of the bureaus. There is a lot of great information in there. They'll also be very useful in when Metro and the state is doing work within the boundaries of the city of Portland, as we've kind of set a factual base, and also actually useful for companies and residents living in the city as they work and live in the city and are able to use this information. So with me here today, Howard Shapiro from the Planning and Sustainability Commission, Eric Engstrom, principal planner and lead on the comprehensive plan. They will review some of the highlights of the reports and the process. And then we have four bureau directors and or other staff that worked on the reports, and they will provide a bit of information. So let me turn it over to Howard first, actually.
Good afternoon, distinguished Mr. Mayor and commissioners. Good to sit before you again. I'm the vice chair of the Planning and Sustainability Commission, and I'm here for two reasons. The first is to recommend the adoption of the factual basis for the city's comprehensive plan. In a series of meetings in March of 2009, the commission held hearings on the factual basis report. I guess I thought about it as finding if there was factual basis to the factual basis is what we were investigating. Sounds a little bit like city government, but that's what we were doing.
Ouch.
And we were not silent in our concerns, our criticisms, and our needs for good and early feedback from city staff on the methodologies used in the analysis. The commission finds these reports to be credible and provide a complete set of facts to be used in setting further policy for the city, so we recommend your adoption of the factual basis report. But secondly, I'm coming before you as the chair and really just a participant of a remarkable group of people called the Citizen Involvement Committee, mandated by the state and the comp plan to provide a comprehensive investigation of what citizens in the city want. And early on in the Portland plan, we established some very important goals and outreach strategies in the committee and then met to consider and work on them. And let me say as an aside, and I think I've said this before, but it's a chance to speak before you and on the record that Portland is remarkable for its volunteerism. We know that. Portland is remarkable for people who are tenacious and want to continue to serve. And I sit on this committee with some of the most tenacious, committed people I've ever worked with. And they're diverse in their age, their gender, their geography, and their politics, but most of everything else. We're united in one thing, and that is making this city the city that we all want to live in 50 years from now. And we're very, very committed to that. So to do that, we established five goals early on. One, build on existing relationships. Two, engage broader and more diverse groups with education and information and provide all the interested with enough education so that they can meaningfully participate and so that citizens can really become involved. To provide multiple venues and means for community involvement and engagement, and I know you all know we've done that, reached out significantly to every part of the community for the Portland plan and beyond, to involve as many people as possible, and with feedback and continuous engagement throughout the Portland plan development and implementation, ensure community members are being heard, ensure that we are being heard. The public participation report contains qualitative measures on how we met those goals and how these goals might be refined and applied through all the stages of the comp plan, which is going forward. So that CIC committee will continue to serve as additional information and concern around the needs we have to meet the comp plan requirements for the state. Thanks.
Thanks, Commissioner.
Thank you. I'm going to briefly go through and summarize the specific information that we put on the table and highlight a few things for you. To start, the comprehensive plan is focused on, and it's already been said that it's a state-mandated activity, but it's focused on land use and infrastructure decision-making in particular. So a lot of these documents are with that aim in mind. It is one of the implementation measures for the Portland plan. There are others, like working on budgets and continuing to work with our partners on direct action. But the land use plan, updating it, is a key implementation strategy. The action today completes task two of the state-mandated periodic review work program. Briefly, the five tasks in that program. Task one was adopted by the council in 2010 and subsequently accepted by the state in 2011. It's the public outreach program for the whole project. And it created the CIC that Howard is the chair of. The second task is the research and analysis phase. We're moving into tasks 3 and 4 now with the creation of the policy expert groups, which are diving into the topic areas of the comprehensive plan and coming researching alternatives and new policy direction options. The final phase is an implementation phase, which I would describe as similar to a regulatory improvement package, but instead of 50 small policy changes, it's 3 or 4 major policy considerations.
So the 5 reports that I want to focus on for my presentation are the buildable lands inventory, the economic opportunities analysis, natural resources inventory, the housing needs, and the infrastructure conditions and capacity. These 5 really are the core of the facts that we need to submit to the state to provide a foundation for further planning and update of the comprehensive plan. 2 data points that are core to these documents that Susan mentioned already are the projection for 132,000 new households in the city by 2035, and then the planning projection of 147,000 new jobs. These are just forecasts, and they're driving what we plan for. They don't necessarily automatically happen unless we carry out the plan. So starting with the buildable lands inventory, it is a document that focuses on what is our zoned capacity for additional development to accommodate that expected growth over the next 25 years. And it has a methodology that takes 4 steps. It identifies vacant land, identifies of that what's most likely to redevelop. There's a discounting process to identify what some of the constraints might be on that redevelopment, so not all vacant property is going to be fully redevelopable, either from an infrastructure constraint or an environmental constraint. And then we adjust that capacity also to account for things like our mixed-use zones have to be allocated between commercial and residential development, and we have to consider market factors. An example of that is, while Gateway may have zoning that accommodates very large buildings, the market isn't producing that in the near-term horizon, and so we factor in some of those market dynamics. The result is a map that gives us a number as well as a physical geography for where this future development might be accommodated. And the map here also shows the level of constraint that's applied to those properties. So the darker properties are properties that are more heavily discounted or constrained, therefore have less capacity to accept redevelopment. And the lighter properties, which you probably can't see very well on these screens, are the ones that are less constrained.
So give an example of something that's 40 to 60% constrained. What does that mean?
That means that we have made a list of the potential constraints of that property, whether their infrastructure could be a street traffic constraint or a sewer constraint or a slope constraint. And we've made assumptions about how much each of those constraints affect the redevelopment capacity. And then we combine all that into a combined constraint. So a 40 to 80% constrained property means that we've taken approximately half or more of that assumed capacity from zoning off the table from our capacity assumption.
And that includes things like E-zones as well?
E-zones are part of that mix, okay. Yeah. Thanks. And whether it's fully in the 80 to 100% or the 40 to 80% or the 0 to 40 depends on how many constraints it has and how serious those constraints are. So an example of 100% constrained property might be something with a P-zone that precludes development or a public park that is not available for housing. This is the equivalent map for employment, and I think there'll be some discussion in the testimony today about this. So that's one piece of information that's part of this. The second report I want to highlight is the economic opportunities analysis, and that goes into greater depth with the employment side of this equation, and it looks at what are the employment forecasts and trends that we need to be looking at, and what does that mean for our employment needs in different sectors of the economy and what kind of land we might need over the next 25 years. So it has 4 sections. It looks at trends and market factors. It looks at the forecast and takes the metro forecast, which was for the entire region, and distributes it to the different sectors of the city for the city's allocation. And the third step then looks at that supply that was from the buildable lands inventory that I already mentioned, and tries to reconcile the supply and demand and identify where we have surplus or shortfalls in that supply. And then the fourth step is really aimed at the next part of this planning exercise, which is about looking at policy alternatives. It doesn't settle on any of those alternatives yet, but it starts to make a list of those possible alternative paths that we could take. And so your action today really isn't adopting any of those alternatives per se, other than the report identifies some of them. As I said, it builds off the Metro regional forecast. Metro allocated 147,000 households, jobs to Portland. That's about a 1.3% annual growth rate, and it represents a 27% capture rate of the entire region's job forecast. So that's the percent that would be within the city. And just to give some context for that, historically, that's consistent with the long-term trend of 25%. It's notable, though, that in the 2000 to 2008 period, there was a significant departure from that trend, and that the city actually lost jobs relative to the region and did not meet that regional capture rate. So one important thing to note here is we are planning for a more aggressive capture rate in this work. And we believe that that's the right policy decision to make to achieve our economic goals that we laid out in the Portland plan. The allocation of employment needs is based on this geography, and essentially what this does is try and identify the different types of employment geographies. Not all employment land need is the same. Some firms need larger parcels. Some firms operate in buildings downtown. Others work at the neighborhood corridor level. And so we tried to allocate to those different geographies, and this map shows that. This chart just shows you the actual allocation, the end result of that analysis, showing that the central city, by our projections, remains the largest recipient of job growth over the next 25 years, with industrial and commercial corridors coming in second. And then notable is that institutions like colleges and hospitals represent a big share of the expected growth at 16%. There's a small percentage of jobs that go to residential land, which represents people doing business out of their homes, essentially, and that we're not required by the state to plan and accommodate that, but that's part of the picture. Another important thing to note is that while most of this exercise is based on planning for employment growth, there's an element of it that is not based on employment, and that's a land need that's based on our traded sector economy and the transportation systems that support it. And most importantly, it's aviation, rail, and marine. And so there's been a lot of analysis as part of the EOA and in reference documents that are referenced by the EOA that attempts to quantify what that need will be over the next 25 years and add that into the mix so that we're adequately planning for that. Because Portland serves as the logistical hub for the entire region, it's not as simple as simply looking at jobs per acre and doing the math from that. We have to consider our role in the larger regional economy. The end result of the EOA is this diagram, which shows that in the central city, and to read this, the blue bars are the projected demand in terms of acres of land needed in that geography, and the red bar is the supply that we've estimated. So in the central city, our demand is slightly below supply, with the exception of some needs in the inner east side industrial district that are not met at the sort of sub-geography level, particularly for lower cost space. There's been a lot more employment growth there than in some other parts of the central city, and so we're a little bit short there. On the industrial side, there's a significant shortfall of more than a few hundred acres. On the commercial side, you can see there's more than adequate supply of land for commercial corridor development of our major non-central city streets and corridors. And then for institutions, there's a slight shortfall in the expected supply and demand for institutional, again, hospitals and colleges and those sorts of campus kind of land uses. The next report I want to highlight is the natural resource inventory, which helps us give some environmental context for our planning. It's based on a detailed science-based methodology to inventory the significant natural resources of the city and provide some quality and quantity understanding of that. And I want to caveat this by saying that this exercise is not being used, the vote that we're asking you to take on this is not being used to establish new zoning that will affect people's property directly. We're asking you to use this inventory for citywide comprehensive planning purposes. If the council would want to use this information to update things like our environmental zoning program in the future, you could do that, but that's not what we're asking you to do with this task. Right now, we're limited to using this information for large-scale planning purposes. Examples of where you've used this at a more local level are things like the Airport Futures Plan, the ongoing Hayden Island Plan, and the River Plan, where you've taken this kind of analysis and actually tried to update our environmental zoning program. So those are examples where we've done that, and we're not asking you to do that with this particular adoption yet. So to show that the inventory is based on a feature-based assessment of the landscape, and it takes into account the up-to-date technology that we have that gives us a lot more information than we had before about the location of slopes and trees and streams and features like that are the basis of this inventory. From that, it focuses on assessing the relative quality of those resources from a riparian perspective and a wildlife habitat perspective, and it eventually scores those different functions. So this is just an example of one of those maps showing you how that comes together into a cumulative ranking of those different riparian functions that resources provide. And again, with wildlife habitat, it goes through a process of identifying functional quality of those resources and rolls that up into ranks. Ultimately, that comes together in a combined ranking of relative quantity and quality of resources throughout the city, and it rolls up to a citywide map. And again, this is really useful for citywide planning so we know where we're putting growth and what impact that may have on natural resources throughout the city. The next report that I briefly want to highlight is the Housing Opportunities Report. Overall, our conclusion with the housing analysis and the buildable lands inventory was that we actually have enough zone capacity in our current zoning to provide more than enough housing supply just in terms of numbers. So unlike some previous planning exercises where we had to make quotas for upzoning different parts of town, we have no upzoning imperative with this project. If we choose to upzone, we can do that for other policy reasons, but there's no overall quota that's derived from this inventory of need. What we did note, though, was that it may matter when you look down to the different types of housing that is provided by the supply that we have. And as it's noted here, the estimated capacity of the city is 230,000 dwelling units over the next 25 years, whereas our need is only 130,000. So we have substantial leeway there. The big issue, though, is not the numbers, but the affordability of that housing. And so our partnership with the Housing Bureau on this comprehensive plan activity is really crucial here. Affordability will continue to be the dominant trend that we're facing with housing over the next 25 years. The last report that I want to highlight is the Infrastructure Condition and Capacity Report, which gives us the basis for what we need to do with infrastructure vis-a-vis the expected growth. And as you know, the city provides and maintains infrastructure systems for water, sewer, transportation, parks, and other civic services. We're also, we work with several key partners, such as the school districts and TriMet, just to name a few, that are key to providing services for population growth. Key recommendations from this report are to look at our service levels vis-a-vis equity, and that's a key finding from the Portland Plan. Look at geographically sensitive infrastructure approaches, for example, with transportation in terms of the one-size-fits-all recipe that we have for street improvements. that's a dominant theme within a lot of different infrastructure is the geographic sensitivity. Financial constraints is a dominant issue that I'm sure you're all familiar with, and that's a huge issue for this comprehensive plan moving forward, that we can identify the infrastructure needs that we may have to meet our growth needs, but that doesn't mean we have the financial resources to provide that infrastructure, and we're going to have to get very creative with that. And the report outlines the importance of continuing to integrate asset management practices into our infrastructure systems, which has been an ongoing activity. Howard talked about the public participation report that we're also asking you to adopt, and this is part of our ongoing obligation with state periodic review, is that we document our public involvement with every step of the way, including the fact-finding. And Howard mentioned that I think it's probably up to a dozen hearings that the Planning Commission held on the factual basis, looking at each of the reports and in great detail and vetting them publicly. Through the Portland Plan, we also provided additional venues for vetting the facts through citywide workshops and mailings and questionnaires, we really set a new bar in terms of exposing this work to more than the usual suspects through the Portland Plan. So this kind of report, I would also mention, is very useful for staff to document what worked and what didn't work in the process, and it's quite direct in terms of what didn't work, so it's worth a read. We will continue to do this with each step of the comprehensive plan to try and learn from our mistakes and successes at each step. So turning this work into the state is part of our obligation, so we're asking you to adopt that report as well. I want to give a quick assessment, because beyond the five reports that I highlighted, there's a box of information here that is the supporting record that is the rest of the documentation that goes into those reports and companion reports, as well as a set of maps, which are the geographic information that ties to this all together. And I'm going to quickly sort of roll through these maps in slides just so you get a sense of it. It's a tremendous amount of information. We're putting it in the record for this, and the Planning Commission spent quite a bit of time on it. So, again, a very sort of animated view of all the different geographic data that we looked at that affects the growth potential of the city. These are the layers that really affect whether property is deemed redevelopable and the level of constraint that applies to those properties. This data is sort of the basis of all that analysis.
Are these maps available online?
They are all online and have been for a long time.
And how would a person find them?
They're highlighted in both the Comprehensive Plan website, and they've been highlighted through the Portland Plan website for quite a long time.
So if they go to the Planning and Sustainability's website, is there a tab for the Comprehensive Plan?
Yes, as well as either through the Portland Plan or the Comprehensive Plan, both would direct you to this information. There's a Portland Plan Atlas that was used as the home for this for a long time.
Thank you.
So again, a tremendous amount of geographic information goes into this model. And that concludes my presentation.
So if it's okay with council, I'd like to go to testimony. We've kept people waiting. We have five people signed up.
And we also have four representatives from the bureaus that would like to do a couple minutes each. So would you like to have those first before the other testimony or after?
After.
Okay.
Yep. And Mayor, you also mentioned that the record would stay open for a week. You might want to specify the date when it closes.
Sue?
September 12th.
September 12th?
5 p.m. September 12th.
5 p.m. September 12th, the record will close. Well, that's
let's see, the vote will be taken in the morning session.
Oh, then the record.
So
what you may want to do is extend the record for the public to a week, and then change that date for the final vote so that staff has a week to respond, and then you decide whether there's any amendments at that point or not, and that would read
5 p.m. on the 12th, the record will be open, and then what do we have the week after for a council date?
That'll be the 19th.
19th at what time?
The 9:30 session.
9:30 session, great. Thank you very much, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Can you call the five members of the public that have signed up to testify? four of the five.
The first four are Tom Bullion, Dave Harvey, Steve Pfeiffer, Peter Fry, and then they'll be followed by Bob Salinger.
I can wait for Bob.
Bob had to go pick up his kids. He has a statement for the record.
Yeah, we have a statement from him. So we just have these four. I mean, we have these four. We are lucky. Who would like to begin? Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Mayor Adams and members of the council for the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. Your packet should include...
And you are?
Oh, I am Tom Bullion. I'm with the Port of Portland. So your packet should include written testimony from the Port of Portland, and it's primarily focused on the economic opportunities. Thank you. It's primarily focused on the economic opportunities analysis. I'd like to describe in a bit more detail one area of concern that we have in the EOA, and that specifically is the suggestion that the Port of Vancouver could be a surrogate for harbor lands within the city of Portland. As an example, Section 4 of the EOA on page 17 states that Vancouver is an alternative for marine terminals and their port has available land. We're concerned that this suggestion provides for a flawed factual base and sets the city up for a series of untenable choices as the comp plan update enters into Task 3 consideration of alternatives. Our five specific concerns include the following. First, this approach is not consistent with other documents, proposes a factual base for the comp plan. For example, the housing needs analysis before you this afternoon does not suggest that Vancouver could provide an alternative location to accommodate Portland's future share of housing demand. Second, we feel this approach is not consistent with Oregon Statewide Planning Goal 9, which requires Portland to maintain a 20-year supply of employment land, including land for marine industrial uses. State law does not allow consideration of land outside the city, and particularly in another state. Third, the Port of Vancouver does not have nearly the amount of shovel-ready marine industrial land available as is suggested in the EOA. As noted in the memo submitted with our letter, the 350-acre Columbia Gateway Parcel 3 contains several significant constraints, including site inundation from the 96 flood and almost complete designation in the 100-year floodplain, approximately 110 acres of wetlands, and extensive shoaling, including shallow water habitat along the Columbia River frontage. Fourth, providing for Portland's marine industrial need in Vancouver is, we believe, is contrary to several key concepts from the recently adopted Portland plan, including economic prosperity and affordability, equity, and healthy connected city. Fifth, shifting marine industrial land along with associated jobs and investment to Vancouver means less income tax, payroll tax, property tax, and system development charges to fund essential public services for the city, county, TriMet, state of Oregon, among other public agencies. In conclusion, we urge you to delete references in the EOA to Vancouver as a potential location to solve the city's marine industrial land shortfall. Thank you for your consideration.
Mayor, can I just ask one quick question? You know, your comment about the law not allowing us to consider availability of industrial land in Vancouver kind of reminds us that there are other parts of the country where there are bi-state compacts on, like, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, where they do plan on a more of a regional basis. You said that state law doesn't allow us to do that, but I guess just I'd be curious your opinion. Do you think Oregon at some point should consider that kind of model of pooling our resources and thinking about the available land in a regional framework?
I guess I'm not sure if that's a very viable or likely outcome. It's fair to say that both ports collaborate on marketing large capital projects like the Columbia River Navigation Channel deepening. The Port of Portland even leases a floating dock to the Port of Vancouver for its Subaru auto account. But I guess the point still remains that the Goal 9 requires the, aside from a bilateral port cooperation, it still requires the City of Portland to consider the basically land base within its own boundaries.
Thank you.
Hi, Dave Harvey. I'm here representing Gunnarsson and the Working Waterfront Coalition. Thanks for having me. Thanks for taking the testimony. Thanks really to the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability for their hard work, their good work, and really considering input from a broad category of individuals, companies, and members of the public. You have a whole packet of documents. I'm actually going to refer to a graphic that you have. If you want to, that's the main thing that I'm going to be looking at. Before I do that, I would say that we've come a long way. We're close. I appreciate the fact that you're leaving the record open, and I think that'll hopefully get us the rest of the way there. Also, in the testimony, I'd like to endorse what the Port of Portland said and what you'll be hearing from Schnitzer as well. I'm going to take my brief time to talk about the opportunity side of the equation, namely, why are we here? And that's what I'm looking at. If you look at the graphic, that's basically where the people that work at Gunnarsson live. That's where a good chunk of them live. That's about 350 people. And so what I believe is that the people of Gunnarsson are the people of Portland. The people of the Working Waterfront are the people of Portland. It's not just a localized area. It's something where we provide the kinds of jobs that I think people help to build up their families, pay their rent, pay their mortgages, all the different things that go on there. And at Gunnarsson, they also happen to get a good benefits package, and they have medical care and all the other things that go along with it. So when we're looking at it from an opportunity point of view, we're looking at prosperous workers. They're the folks that are buying goods at their local stores. And if one other thing is that the page after this graphic, it talks about the diversity that's at Portland. And I think that companies like Portland, like Gunnarsson, really are part of the answer to the equity aspect or the equity considerations that really are of issue throughout the city. So I'll just wrap up by saying these industrial lands are important. They're important for the kinds of jobs that have an impact beyond just what is in the harbor. And I think we're part of the solution. Thanks.
Peter?
Yeah, I was going to capture this 28 minutes.
No.
No. Peter Finley Fry, I'm vice chair of the Central East Side Land Use Committee, and I wanted to focus on Central East Side and Lower Albina. They talked about the fact that there's an industrial land shortage in those districts, but they didn't really say how much. It's actually about 20%. It's about 60, 70 acres that's short. And what the EOA discovered was it discovered a new and emerging market that is existing throughout the nation, in New York and downtown LA. And this is an industrial office market. And it's not like commercial office. It has basically different form and different function. I saw 3 days ago an industrial office building, drawings of one that's being proposed in Central East Side and has high ceilings, large open spaces, concrete floors, industrial size elevators, and interior truck loading and unloading. These buildings are specialized. They don't have drop ceilings. They're not law offices. And the function of this market is different as well, because in these areas, they create physical and intellectual products. And these products could be made anywhere in the world because of the internet, but they create the concepts. And the EOA, thankfully, has revealed this market to us, and I'm thankful for that. Well, not perfect. The EOA is a huge step forward in understanding the economic structure of our city. And I wanted to just a passing comment. Yesterday, we're trying to work with the Planning and Sustainability and BDS, trying to distinguish between a horse and a cow. I mean, once you let the horse in, is it going to become a cow? And how do you regulate that? And so we've been working with real estate experts to try and describe what this industrial office is and why it's not a commercial office and how it can be regulated. And at that panel we had yesterday of real estate experts, they actually revealed something that's quite surprising to us all. and that is traditional lenders are now leaving the suburbs and returning to the core nationally, and that insurance companies and pension funds are looking at Central East Side and downtown, as you know, and Lower Albina, because people are now choosing to come back for energy costs, for social costs, for a lot of reasons. And so that speaks very well of Portland.
Thank you, Mr. Pratt. Hi, welcome back.
Mayor, Commissioner, Steve Pfeiffer here today on behalf of Schnitzer Steel Industries. I've submitted written comments, which will be available to you shortly. I've shared those with Catherine and Eric only briefly today, so they haven't had a chance to really digest them. I can be brief and concise and to the point. We support your efforts in periodic review, notwithstanding the significant drain it has on your, on certainly the planning program, like this and every other city. From my own view, periodic review probably isn't as valuable in most communities as it is in Portland, because you're suffering the dynamics over time. We are collectively more than almost any other community, so my own sense is it's time well spent. We're focused on these comments on the EOA specifically, and even more specifically on the working harbor aspects of the EOA. And really, there are five bulleted points on page two of the letter that really, really summarize the comments that we offer, and they go pretty much to the methodology, but that methodology is critical, as you know. You got a serial process here with five tasks. The next one's going to be alternatives, and if you don't get it right in tasks one and two, then three and four will suffer over time. Our sense is this, and it's based on the practical experience of certainly Schnitzer, as well as others who they collaborate with on a regular basis in the working harbor. It's a unique area with unique users and unique needs. And if I had to summarize those comments, we would urge the Bureau, for the reasons we articulate there, to have another look at really three categories. The unique site characteristics, which are the working harbor, particularly the water-dependent, water-related aspects of it. They have different lot sizes. They have different FARs. They have different needs. And those needs, to some extent, change over time, but many of them will remain with us for a long time to come. Secondly, on that point, other parts of the area will benefit from redevelopment or intensification of existing available land supplies. That, in our opinion, is less likely to be the case in the harbor. And while I understand for efficiency and other reasons, the city has to make some assumptions on, for instance, intensification and redevelopment throughout the city because your EOA is citywide. Site, unique site characteristics, unique history, both current and moving forward, lead us to wonder if, again, we shouldn't be a bit more conservative on the redevelopment aspects and the extent to which that will be available and therefore may serve to understate, if we don't get it right, the buildable lands available over time. Thirdly, brownfields. Goes to the same point. Brownfields get redeveloped. You know, a dry cleaner on a corner of two arterials with 25,000 ADT a day is going to get redeveloped because the land values there are such that you can carry that redevelopment and the cleanup. That is much less likely in $4, $5, and $6 square foot dirt. It's one of the reasons, independent of Superfund, while you see large parcels remain unremediated in the working harbor. And the assumptions on brownfield, we simply point out, need to be unique to the harbor, to those circumstances, even before you get to Superfund. And when you get to Superfund, for reasons we explained, PPAs are not as readily available. Those land costs affect us. The magnitude of the scale and the scale and nature of the contamination, we need to be more cautious on brownfield redevelopment because, again, if we overstate it, our supply will be overstated and we'll fall short in a few years. Thank you.
I'll be coming to council in a couple of weeks in partnership with Portland Development Commission. We did sent a request for anyone who needs assistance to every landowner and business in the North Reach area. And to your points, I think each of your points, we got some good requests for assistance back and future work as well. And many of them deal with the issues that you've outlined. I don't have a copy of the Ports letter, and I don't have a copy. You didn't submit anything, right?
We will, though.
Okay, great. Can you give a...
Thank you.
Great. Thank you all. If we could have staff come up then. Do you want the staff or the panel? That was the panel.
Do you want staff or the bureau directors?
What panel? We have panel and staff? We have a quick... bureau managers come up. You each have 10 seconds. No, I'm kidding.
I don't need that much.
I'll yield my time.
Parks and Housing will take as long as you need. make a full and complete record.
As long as I get to go first, and then I
appreciate you giving up half a day for 30 seconds.
Director Quintum.
Thank you for the opportunity. I'll be quick. I just wanted to reinforce all the great work that's been done on this analysis, and particularly on the industrial land, employment land analysis, and the economic opportunity analysis. This council knows we've been working for 3 years under an economic development strategy that is focused at its core on traded sector job growth. And despite the fact that we started the implementation of that strategy and at the depths of the recession, we are now beginning to see signs of life. We've added 15,000 jobs in Multnomah County since the adoption of the strategy, but that's not nearly enough to replace the jobs lost in the recession. There still are significant numbers of people who are unemployed. If we're to continue on this trend, we need to continue our focus on traded sector job growth. Traded sector firms, we all know the benefits of that. They expand our economy, they pay higher wages, and they typically have a multiplier effect which supports multiple jobs. So among the many things that we need to do to support our traded sector industries, and those things do include access to skilled talent, access to risk capital, access to deep supply chains throughout the region, but these industries need a supply of industrial land, and they also need a supply of employment lands if we're talking about the non-industrial traded sector firms. You've heard the analysis on the impending shortfall in industrial land. And I just, this is a very nuanced topic. It's not the case that you can say I make 10 parcels available and I can guarantee that 10 parcels are going to get used. When we have opportunities, whether it's through recruitments or expansions, the region works together to meet those needs. And the region might meet a particular need in Hillsborough, might meet it in Portland, it might meet it in Vancouver. But if Portland's going to get its share of these opportunities, and particularly the opportunities that match our competitive strengths and access to the port, access to the airport, access to transportation networks, access to talent, those things all are competitive advantages, then the city needs to have an available supply of industrial land. There are lots of things we can talk about in future discussions, whether it be brownfields and other things, but we are certainly ready to help on that. And I want to emphasize both points that were made in the previous testimony. There is the industrial land supply. There's also the supply of commercial space for startup firms, younger firms, the Class B and C space that we see on the Central East Side. Both are critical needs to grow in the economy. Both should be priorities as we move forward in the implementation of the comprehensive plan. So,
but also thanks. For the Central East Side, we also, I would just add to your great testimony is, for example, Peter, wherever Peter Finley Fry is, on the Central East Side, we have an issue of the viability of unreinforced masonry buildings to convert from previous uses to the new office industrial. So funding mechanisms, it's sort of one of those strategic challenges like brownfields that we have,
right,
in what otherwise has been as preserved as actually a district that's quite beyond, except for that, well-suited for the industries of the future. So
right,
those are two issues that I would underscore as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Marriott?
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. Dean Marriott, Environmental Services. I want to first thank Susan Anderson and the staff of Planning and Sustainability for the excellent work and collaborative work with all the bureaus. This matter has come before the Planning and Development Directors at our regular meetings on many occasions in order to solicit the teamwork, and it's been, I think, successful. For the first time, this comprehensive plan is going to include issues like watershed health, green infrastructure, endangered species, even climate change, and that's a very positive thing. We were able to assist in the infrastructure conditions and capacity report, the natural resources inventory, urban forestry background report, watershed health background report. On watershed health, I don't need to beat this drum any further, but for no other reason than to say we've spent literally billions of dollars of investment to protect watershed health and improve watershed health, particularly related to the Willamette. And it's important to include that feature in the comp plan, if for no other reason than to just simply protect that investment. On the economic opportunity analysis, you've heard a lot of this, and I second Patrick's notion that let's come back and talk about this some more. One of the things that I notice when I look at that industrial land inventory and the shortage that's described, they discount brownfield property from the list of available properties. So one way to tackle the shortage is to tackle the problem of brownfields. And We stand ready to assist. We've been able to secure grants from EPA worth millions of dollars to help with assessment and cleanup on brownfields. It's not enough, but it's a small step forward, and we look forward to working with all of you in the future to make sure that work gets done. Thank you.
Hi. Hi, good afternoon. I'm Brett Horner. I'm the planning and design manager for Portland Parks. On behalf of our director, Mike Abate, we are happy to see this come before you today and also to have contributed to its development. I just have a few key points to mention. Firstly, parks are included and highlighted in the infrastructure and conditions report. We chose to do that even though state law does not require it in order to really highlight the importance of parks and natural areas as essential components of public infrastructure. Secondly, service levels established in our Parks 2020 vision have also been included. And key one of these is getting every resident within a half mile of a park. So that's in the infrastructure report, and we'll follow through in the comp plan. Thirdly, natural areas and recreational trails are also recognized as key city assets. This is very encouraging to see for the first time. And finally, we are really happy to see the city's green infrastructure highlighted and included, as Dean mentioned. So the background reports are not just focused on the hard assets and the traditional built assets of our city, but also include the green infrastructure. In addition to our parks and natural areas, our urban forestry program is highlighted on page 95 of the infrastructure report, and it will continue to play an important role in maintaining, expanding, and enhancing the city's unique green infrastructure. Thank you.
Also, if I may, just one note, Mayor. The comment that was made about percentage of Portlanders that are within a, was it half mile of a developed park? We're making steady progress there, but the truth is that every 10 years or so, we go out to the voters for a bond measure to actually have the dollars to build out our capital dollars to build out the system, because there just isn't enough SDC money and other dollars in the pipeline. The deficit that has been identified is still east of 205, and so we cannot tackle that without a bond measure, which is why I know it's a little tardy since you assigned this to me a few years ago, but better late than never, why we're going to go out next year for a bond measure so that we can have some of the resources to close that gap and make sure that more of the families in East Portland also have access to Ball Park.
Thanks. Thank you. Hi.
Hi. My name is Danielle Ledesma. I lead our equity policy and communications team at the Portland Housing Bureau. And on behalf of our director, Tracy Manning, we wanted to appreciate the thoroughness with which the issues of housing availability, affordability, and connectedness are examined in the reports and our collaboration with the BPS staff to develop them. We have the shared goal of assuring that the update of the comprehensive plan proactively addresses issues of equitable opportunity for healthy, well-located, and affordable homes for historically underserved Portlanders, especially communities of color and people with disabilities. The report shows a continuing challenge to provide an adequate supply of affordable homes, especially for low- and middle-income households, and a need to, number one, preserve existing housing and communities at risk of displacement, and number two, create new affordable opportunities for housing located close to transportation and amenities. The report also shows that these issues are not a zoning problem. We have lots of zone capacity for housing. We are working together to identify other strategies to increase affordable housing, especially policies and programs that support private development of moderate income workforce housing that also responds to city housing priorities. The analysis also makes an important shift in defining affordability that also considers housing and transportation costs, that puts more emphasis on location and access to jobs and essential services. Focusing on creating more affordable homes in these high opportunity areas with the infrastructure and services to support these households and their success will be an important strategy to avoid displacement of existing residents. We look forward to continuing the collaborative work between the Housing Bureau and BPS in developing a housing strategy and policies for the comprehensive plan that we hope will help move these issues forward.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you. All right. Does any we'll leave the record open, and staff will be coming back to us individually.
before we meet again as a group to go through these issues. So as outlined earlier in this hearing is continued. Can you please read the title for item number 1002?
Establish rates for stormwater management services in the areas of the city served by Multnomah County Drainage District Number 1, Peninsula Drainage District Number 1, and Peninsula Drainage District Number 2, and commence direct billings.
Thank you. Jim, you're violating protocol, but that's all right. Give it to Carla. She's going to slap you now.
No, he's not.
Normally, yeah. Normally she tackles people.
It's late in the
afternoon. All right, what are we looking at here, Director Marriott?
Mr. Mayor, we're Mr. Saltzman was going to introduce this item, and here he is.
Just in time delivery.
Okay.
I'm trying.
Fastest gavel in the West. Okay, well,
you have 90 minutes for this, and I think you can do it more quickly.
I think we can too.
Dan, do you have any amendments? Because I think the amendments are now closed.
Did you guys already put a substitute? Did you put a substitute on the table?
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Mayor and my colleagues. We are here today to consider a change in how the city recovers cost of stormwater management in the drainage districts. Since 2000, instead of directly billing customers in the drainage district for stormwater charges, there has been an intergovernmental agreement between the city and the districts for stormwater cost recovery. After unsuccessful negotiations to renew the intergovernmental agreements, the city provided notice to the districts in 2006 that these intergovernmental agreements would expire on June 30th, 2012, and that the city then intended to resume direct billing of district stormwater customers. So the proposal for you before you today is to do exactly that. It's to resume direct billing for city stormwater management within the districts. The charge is only for the off-site portion of stormwater, which is 65% of the stormwater bill. So in other words, 35%, we are assuming people manage their stormwater effectively on-site, so we're only trying to get the 65%. And that's indeed a lot of residents throughout the city do, in fact, get the stormwater discount and also pay.
1-0. Office of Neighborhood Involvement on the first floor requests immediate security assistance. For your safety, City Hall occupants should remain clear of Office of Neighborhood Involvement until further notice. 110. 110. Office of Neighborhood Involvement on the first floor requests immediate security assistance. For your safety, City Hall occupants should remain clear of Office of Neighborhood Involvement until further notice. 1.
Please continue.
So ultimately, the intent of this proposal is to bring drainage district property owners in line with what all ratepayers throughout the city pay in terms of a stormwater charge, the full offsite charge. This offsite charge goes to cover stormwater runoff from all public rights of way. It goes to support watershed enhancement activities. It also goes to support the cost of getting a permit from the EPA, our municipal stormwater permit, which is it's a huge undertaking. And we're also, in return, the city is proposing to pay its drainage district for managing public rights of way inside the district boundaries. So our original proposal was to recover our full cost in about 2 years. And I'm putting forward today a substitute proposal that's a reflection of the public involvement process we've had and what we've heard from constituents as well as my colleagues on the council. And the alternative delays the implementation date and adds in more transition years to achieving the 65% stormwater rate. In essence, we would propose, and the PowerPoint gets into this, I won't. In essence, we would propose starting this February to recover 17% of our cost, which basically covers the cost for this fiscal year that started July 1st. We have not been paid by the drainage districts, the $670,000. So it's, in essence, recovering what's owed us